Welcome to the January 12, 2021 afternoon session of the Nebraska Court of Appeals, our court's first oral arguments for 2021. I'm Rico Bishop. I'm pleased to be joined by Judge Francie Reedman and Judge Larry Welch. I'd also like to welcome our new bailiff, Jody Schmidt, who's keeping this running smoothly for us. Thank you, Jody. Also want to send out some thanks to the clerk's office and our IT experts for all their good work and setting up the details for these WebEx oral arguments during these ongoing days of the pandemic. So thank you to them for all their help. So these oral arguments are being live streamed and recorded by NETV and will be posted to the Nebraska Supreme Court's website for public viewing. So please be mindful, as always, of that in the event you intend to share any confidential or sensitive information. There is a view on your screen of your 10-minute clock, so please watch your time accordingly. And also, when you can, please try to remember to mute your computer's microphone when you are not presenting your argument. So with that, we'll get started with our first case of the day, In Re Trust of Roll, and the appellant can proceed.
Thank you, Justice Bishop, Justice Reedman, and Justice Welch. I'd also like to thank the Ms. Schmidt and the staff over there at the Court of Appeals for facilitating this argument today. My name is Travis Jaycott, and together with Patrick Sullivan, we represent the appellant, Charles E. Roll Jr. Revocable Trust, for this appeal. May it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. And for this appeal, it's really about the discretion of a county court in a law action to allow parties to proceed outside of the statutorily prescribed procedures and how many chances a litigant should give without a valid excuse or defense. So there are really three arguments specifically that I'd like to lay out today that go in part with the briefs that have been submitted and the record that has been brought to the court's attention in this case. Number one is that the opinion of the county court that has been affirmed by the district court does not comport with the garnishment laws in the state of Nebraska. Number two, it's the appellant's position that if this standard espoused by the county court is upheld, that would create an untenable policy moving forward for litigants who wish to go through the procedures that Nebraska law allows. And number three, we believe that the facts in this case are of the sort that would require a decision in appellant's favor. So with that first argument, that the county court's order does not comport with Nebraska law. First, it's important to point out that the case cited by the county court, the Corbett case, is not really comparable to this case for a few reasons. Number one, Corbett involved a probate case under the Nebraska probate code. Number two, that case involved a nephew who believed that he was a part of a will that was going to be instituted by the court, that was unaware of an intervening will that was subsequently filed without his knowledge. Once he became aware of the intervening will, he decided to file a claim, claiming that that will was the product of undue influence. So there was clearly a case where a litigant was unaware of what was before the court, really didn't have reason to discover what was before the court because he thought a will which he was a part of was rightfully initiated prior to the intervening will. And number three, once he found out about the intervening will, he did something about it. So it wasn't, he didn't have multiple chances to intervene in the process. Once he found out that he, about the intervening will, he immediately took action to defend his case and present his case. And the court held in that case that because of the circumstances, Corbett should have an opportunity to present his defense. Now, the other main case that has been cited for this appeal is the Lee Sapp case. And Lee Sapp is specifically a case regarding the garnishment procedures. First, it's important to point out Lee Sapp was in the district court, not in the county court. And as the court's aware, the garnishment procedures is a law action usually brought in county court, but at times brought in district court.
Mr. Jacobs?
Yes.
How do we get around the fact that there's actual statutory authority for a county court to vacate a decision rendered within the term?
Yes, Judge. And with that, the crux of our argument for that point is that the district or the county court abused its discretion when it vacated that order. And the main reason why is when the facts of this case, as have been laid out in the record, are reviewed, it shows that one, the individual litigant was provided notice in May that the plaintiff was seeking judgment from that individual. From May until June, he did not respond to the motion filed by the plaintiff. In June, a motion was filed to hold him liable, and there was still a couple weeks for the litigant to be able to respond, in which he didn't. Once we get to the first hearing where the litigant goes before the court, it's July 2nd, that is the point when the litigant was given an opportunity to present a defense as to why he should not be held liable for the debt of the debtor in the from the previous case.
And the garnishee appeared at that hearing, is that correct?
I'm sorry, Justice?
The garnishee appeared at that hearing?
Yes, Justice, he did. And he explained to the court that he didn't respond to the interrogatories because he didn't know what to do. He apparently didn't read the instructions on the document, didn't do due diligence to find out what he needed to do, and he failed to hire an attorney. So at that July 2nd hearing, we believe the judge was gracious to the appellee and granted him an opportunity, 10 more days. So we're here a month and a half later. He was given 10 more days to submit interrogatories, which under statute are to be submitted within 10 days of receiving them. And that's really important. 25-10-28 prescribes that the interrogatory shall be, answered within 10 days. Otherwise, there's a presumption of indebtedness on behalf of the garnishee.
But that presumption, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead, Justice.
That presumption of liability can be overcome, though, right? During the hearing on the application to determine garnishee liability, even if the interrogatories are never filed, right?
Yes, Justice, that is correct. And appellant's position is on July 2nd, garnishee, even though he didn't file the interrogatories, had an opportunity to present a defense. Now, the judge points out in the county court points out that the garnishee did provide some testimony, but that the court never put him under oath. It's not the court's responsibility to present evidence for a litigant. A litigant is required, whether they're pro se or have an attorney, to present evidence, to provide testimony, and to fully defend the case.
Mr. Jacob, what about on July 16th when the second shot at this was provided? Was evidence adduced at that time?
No, Your Honor. Justice, at that hearing, there was further argument provided by the parties, and the court did not disallow evidence to be submitted. The garnishee states on the record that he had answers to interrogatories with him and that he failed to file them because he was afraid it wouldn't get there in time with the mailing. And as the record reflects, if the garnishee was really worried about the court receiving the document in time, the garnishee lives less than 10 miles away from the courthouse, easily could have been filed prior to that hearing.
And did he make any effort to try to offer them at that time?
The record does not reflect that. No, Justice.
Is this different than from the standpoint that there was an opportunity for the production of evidence that the appellee failed to take advantage of and a judgment then entered? So this was not a default judgment, correct?
That is correct. That is correct, Justice.
And so for the county court judge to make a decision based on the lack of a meritorious defense, which generally is associated with a default judgment, do you think that's a significant distinction?
Yes, Justice, and that's part of our main contention, is when you look at the court, the cases such as Lee Sapp, when a litigant was provided an opportunity to give a meritorious defense, they were not afforded that opportunity initially. Whereas here, there were two chances for this garnishee to provide a meritorious defense over the span of 2 months. So two hearings and plenty of time with plenty of instruction for what the garnishee needed to do. And that is how this case is distinguishable from the equitable cases wherein a judgment was vacated.
Would you agree that the county court would have had the authority, even had evidence been submitted at the time of either of those hearings, and then the court entered a judgment favorable to your client? Couldn't the judge, by statute, within the same term, have gone back and just changed the court's mind and vacated it?
Yes, Justice. Under the vacation statute, there's enumerated reasons as to why a court can vacate its own order. And if there was a reason that it should be vacated, certainly the court would have powers to do that by statute. Here, the reasoning given by the court to vacate the order, we believe, doesn't hold water because, as the reason stated in our brief and today, there was plenty of opportunity to present a meritorious defense.
Thank you.
I have about 20 seconds left. I'll just close with this. This case presents an opportunity for, I think, the Court of Appeals to straighten out the garnishment procedures and to make sure that litigants aren't left in limbo for months when a pro se party decides to go outside the bounds of what the rules prescribe and try to handle his own proceeding in a different manner. So with that, we ask this court to overturn the county court's order and enter judgment in favor of appellants.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hale?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm William Hale, and I represent Mark Anderson, doing business as M.E. Anderson Construction, who is the garnishee at the trial level and the appellee here at this court. And we ask that the court dismiss the appeal for lack of jurisdiction because there is not a final appealable order that affects a substantial right. Or in the alternative, we ask that the court affirm the ruling of the district court, which affirmed the order of the county court vacating its own judgment. And the reason for that is because there was not an abuse of discretion. The county court was within its statutorily granted authority to vacate its own order, and it properly did so.
Is it a problem, though, Mr. Hale, that, you know, the basis provided in the order was essentially that there's been a meritorious argument presented, which is generally the consideration when there's been a default judgment previously entered, not a judgment where there was an opportunity to present evidence? So isn't that distinction important here?
Actually, I don't know that that is a distinction that's important here today for a couple of reasons. For one, if you read through the brief of the appellant, it appears that they are trying to say that it should have been a default judgment. The arguments that are made is that the interrogatories were not answered, and so automatically the appellee should have had judgment against it in the amount of the $25,000. On the other hand as well, the appellee in this case, Mark Anderson, did not really have an opportunity to present evidence. He had a couple of hearings, and he tried to present evidence at each of those hearings. On July 2nd, he gave testimony that he only works from temp at times, off and on, and he wasn't sure how to fill out the interrogatories.
But that really wasn't testimony. Weren't these just arguments that were made to the court?
When you have a pro se litigant, it's hard to distinguish the difference between arguments and testimony.
But he wasn't sworn in, right?
Correct. He was not sworn in, but I don't know that that's necessarily his fault. I don't know that as a pro se litigant, he would have had the responsibility to say to the court, hey, court, I'd like to be sworn in so I can give testimony at this time. He doesn't know the difference.
And perhaps that was recognized by the court when it said, I'm going to give you 10 more days. Let's come back and do this hearing again. In the meantime, get an attorney and figure this out.
Potentially. Only the thing to keep in mind with that is at the time of the hearing, before they left that day, he was told that it was taken under advisement so the judge could look at the statutes. That same day, the court entered an order saying it's It's under advisement and I'll give you 10 days. That order wasn't mailed out until July 5th. The next hearing that took place was on July 16th, which is only one day after that 10-day window, where he brought the interrogatories with him to the court. Would have been less than 10 days since he received a copy of the order saying he had 10 days. And so the timing is tight enough there. And the fact that he brought it to the hearing, I think that's important.
He never really attempted to offer them. I mean, as I read that hearing, for one, it's 2 pages in the Bill of Exceptions. And all he tells the court is, I have them now. He never says, and I'd like to give them to the court. I'd like to offer them. Nothing like that.
That may be. It is an unsophisticated pro se litigant, which I know they're held to the same standards as an attorney, but I think that does come into play. This is not, as the court recognized when it vacated its order, this is not malicious. This is not someone who's trying to snub their nose at the system. He dutifully showed up to the hearings, which, might I add, is unlike what happened in the Lee Sapp case. In the Lee Sapp case, the garnishee spent its interrogatories late and did not show up at the hearing. And the court still said that it was an abuse of discretion to not vacate its order. In the other case, other key case that we cite, Spaghetti Limited Partnership v. Wolf, in that case, they did not submit written answers to the interrogatories, but he did show up at the hearing. And the court had said in that case that for one, the trier of fact is entitled to receive evidence from the garnishee with regard to the liability, even if they've not appropriately answered. And the court said that despite their failure to answer the interrogatories, their appearance at that hearing to determine liability defeated the presumption that they would be liable. In this case, the little bit of argument that Mr. Anderson gave, whether you consider it argument or testimony, goes to show that he does have a meritorious defense and he was trying to determine or trying to portray to the court that he did not owe anything to Brandon Anderson, the defendant.
I have a procedural question for you as I'm listening to this. When a garnishee fails to file their interrogatories within 10 days and the court then subsequently sets a hearing, is the issue there simply what's your basis for failing to file it such that it can now be filed? Or is it a step further, which is we're having a full-blown hearing notwithstanding the interrogatories on whether or not there's garnishee liability?
That's a good question. I believe that the hearing would be to determine if there's liability and how much. The statute which creates the presumption, it doesn't say that the garnishee shall be liable. It says that there shall be a presumption and the court may enter judgment for an amount that the court finds is owed. It doesn't have to be the full amount of the $25,000, which is what the appellant is trying to ask for to happen. But it's still a determination. The test is still how much is actually owed by the garnishee to the defendant. Are they paying him wages? Do they have any property of the defendant that would then should be turned over to the plaintiff as part of the garnishment? It's not a determination that, oh, you've missed the deadline, so now you owe a full $25,000, I'm sorry. It is still a determination of how much is really owed and how much should be paid. It's not a transfer of liability. It's a determination that the liability, that the garnishee owes something that should be given as part of the garnishment.
Is there any concern about, you know, allowing parties to delay and delay and delay so that, you know, to the extent there was possession of some assets owed to the defendant here, that allows time for those monies to be dispersed?
Of course, there's a concern about some litigants trying to take advantage of the system and delay for the sake of delaying. But that's why there's a statute that gives a rebuttable presumption. In the Spaghetti Limited Partnership case, it explains that the rebuttable presumption serves two purposes. One, to give that garnishee an incentive to answer in order to avoid the presumption, and two, to provide the appropriate due process of law to the garnishee that innocently or inadvertently failed to answer. In this case, the garnishee innocently failed to answer because he didn't know how. The particular situation that he was in, he didn't know how to answer those. He asked for how that should be answered and still unsure.
Well, and when he was, I mean, that might have been excusable on July 2nd, but was it really still excusable by the 16th?
And by the 16th, he did have those answers with him, which, depending on when you count the timing, was either still within the 10 days, if it counts from when he received the order saying he had an additional 10 days, or it would have been one day later, which, had he mailed it within the 10 days, would have arrived at the court later than him just bringing it to court on the 16th. And so I think that, and as was pointed out, even in the Spaghetti Limited Partnership case, even if he doesn't answer those interrogatories, he still should have a fair and full opportunity to litigate the issue of whether he owes anything. He was not provided that opportunity. That's why the court vacated its own order and set it for further hearing so that he could have that opportunity to determine how much, if anything, is owed.
And is it your position that, you know, they could have just kept continuing this and continuing this thing?
No, of course, at some point, he's not going to keep getting chances. But in this particular case, that point was not reached. This is not a point where he keeps making excuses and trying to get more time and more time just to delay. On that first hearing, July 2nd, he tried to give testimony. And the court didn't swear him in and didn't consider that testimony. At the July 16th hearing, he tried to bring the answers to the interrogatories with him, and those were not accepted by the court.
And it's your position that's on the court. That's the court's fault, so to speak.
I believe that the court, when it vacated its order, was trying to correct some of those errors and make sure that it did have that the garnishee did have a full and fair opportunity. And for those reasons, we ask that the court affirm the decision of the district court, which affirmed the county court vacating its own order. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't believe we have any time left for rebuttal. Is that correct?
That's correct, Judge Bishop.
All right. Well, thank you both very much for your arguments today. The matter is submitted. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Justice.
Thank you.